The drumming continued, booming and pounding against his brain, until he felt him a scream aloud. It seemed to emanate from the very earth, out of the fierce dark slope of rock directly ahead, and it bounced and reverberated from the rock walls of the gorge, driving it upon him in great hammers of sound. Suddenly the Count realized that the darkness was disappearing. He could make out the shape of a stunted cedar tree on the scree slope above his position, where moments before there had been only black shades. The tree looked like some misshapen monster. Quickly the Count averted his eyes and looked upwards. Between the mountains and the narrow strip of sky was defined a paler pink light against the black brooding mass of rock. He dropped his gaze and looked ahead. The darkness retreated rapidly, and the dawn came with dramatic African suddenness. Then the beat of the drums stopped. It was so abrupt, the transition from a pounding sea of sound to the deathly, unearthly silence of the African dawn in the mountains. The shock of it held Old O'Belly transfixed, and he peered, blinking like an owl, up the gorge. There was a new sound, thin and high, as the sound of night birds flying, plaintive and weird, an ululation that rose and fell so that it was many moments before he recognized it as the sound of hundreds upon hundreds of human voices. Suddenly he started, and his chin snapped up. "Mary, Mother of God!" he whispered, as he stared up the gorge. It seemed that the rock was rolling down swiftly upon them, like a dark, fluid avalanche, and the ululation rose, becoming a wild, luluing clamour. Swiftly the light strengthened, and the Count realized that the avalanche was a sweeping tide of human shapes. "Pray for us, sinners," breathed the Count, and crossed himself swiftly. And at that instant he heard Castellani's voice, like the bellow of a wild bull, out of the darkened Italian positions. Instantly the machine guns opened, together in a thunderous hammering roar that drowned out all other sound. The tide of humanity seemed no longer to be moving forward, like a wave upon a rocket, broke on the Italian guns, and milled and eddied about the growing reef of their own fallen bodies. The light was stronger now. Strong enough for the Count to see clearly the havoc that entrenched machine guns made of the mass charge of Harari warriors. They fell in thick swathes, dead upon dead, as the guns traversed back and forth. They piled up in banks in front of the Italian positions, so that those still coming on had to clamber over the fallen, and when the guns swung back, they too fell, building a wall of bodies. The Count's terror was forgotten in the fascination of the spectacle. The racing figures coming down the narrow gorge seemed endless, like ants from a disturbed nest. Like fields of moving wheat, and the guns reaped them with great scythe strokes and piled them in deep windrows. Yet here and there a few of the racing figures came on, reached the barbed wire that Castellani had strung, beat it down with their swords, and were through. Of those who breached the wire, most died on the very lips of the Italian trenches, shot to bloody pieces by close-range volleys of rifle fire. But a few, a very few, came on still. A group of three figures leapt the wire at a point where two dead Ethiopians had fallen and dragged it down, making a breach for those who followed. They were led by a tall, skeletal figure in swirling white robes. He was bald, and the pate of his head gleaming like a black cannonball, and perfect white teeth shone in the sweat-coiled face. He carried only a sword, as long as the spread of a man's arms, and as broad as the span of his hand, and he swung the huge blade lightly about his head as he jinked and dodged with the agility of a goat. The two warriors who followed him carried ancient Martini Henry rifles, which they fired from the hip as they ran, each shot blowing a long, thick blue flag of black powder smoke, while the leader swung the sword above his head and lulued a wild war cry. A machine gun picked up the group neatly, and a single burst cut down two of them, but the tall leader came on at a dead run. The Count, peering over the turret of the tank, was so astonished by the man's persistence that his own fear was momentarily forgotten. In the tank parked beside his, the machine gun fired. A ripping, tearing burst. And this time, the racing white-clad figure staggered suddenly, and Aldo Belli saw the bullet strike, lifting tiny pale puffs of dust from the warrior's robes and leaving bloody splotches across the chest. Yet he came on running, still howling, and he leapt the first line of trenches, coming straight down towards the line of tanks, and it seemed as though he'd recognised the Count as his particular adversary. His charge seemed to be directed at him alone, and he was suddenly very close. Standing fascinated in the turret, Aldo Belli could clearly see the staring eyes in the deeply lined face, and noticed the incongruity of the man's rows of perfect white teeth. His chest was sodden with dark red blood, but the swinging sword in his hands hissed through the air, and the dawn light flickered on the blade like summer lightning. The machine gun fired again, and this time the burst seemed to tear the man's body to pieces. The Count saw shreds of his clothing and the flesh fly from him in a cloud, yet incredibly he kept coming onwards, staggering and dragging the sword beside him. The last burst of fire struck him, and the sword dropped from his hand. He sank to his knees, but kept crawling. Now he'd seen the Count, and his eyes fastened on the white man's face. He tried to shout something, but the sound was drowned in a bright flooding gout of blood that filled his open mouth. The crawling, mutilated figure reached the hull of the stationary tank, and the Italian guns fell silent, almost as though in awe of the man's tenacity. Laboriously, the dying warrior dragged his broken body up towards the Count, watching him with a terrible dying anger. And the Count fumbled nervously with the ivory butt of his Beretta, slipping a fresh clip of cartridges into the recessed butt. "Stop him, you fools!" he cried. "Kill him! Don't let him get in!" But the guns were silent. With shaking hands, the Count slapped the magazine home and lifted the pistol. At a range of 6 feet, he sighted briefly into the crawling Ethiopian. He emptied the magazine of the Beretta in frantic haste, the shots crashing out in rapid succession in the sudden silence that hung over the field. A bullet struck the warrior in the centre of his sweat-glazed forehead, leaving a perfectly round black hole in the gleaming brown skin, and the man slithered backwards and then rolled down the hull, coming to rest at last upon his back. And he stared up at the swiftly lightening sky with wide, unseeing eyes. Out between the slack lips dropped a set of artificial teeth, and the old mouth collapsed and fell inwards. The Count was shaking still, but then, quite unexpectedly, a surging emotion swept away the terrors that had gripped him. He felt a vast, proprietorial sense of emotional involvement with the old man he'd killed. He wanted to take some part of him, some trophy of his skill. He wanted to scalp him or take his head and have it cured so that he might preserve this moment forever. But before he could move, there was the shrilling of whistles and a bugle began urgently to sound the advance. On the slope ahead of them, only the dead lay in their piles and mounds, while the last of those who had survived that crazy, suicidal charge were disappearing like wisps of smoke back among the rocks. The road to Sardi was open, and like the hard professional he was, Luigi Castellani seized the chance. As the bugle sang its brassy command, the Italian infantry rose from the trenches and the formation of tanks rumbled forward. The corpse of the ancient Harari warrior lay directly in the track of the command tank, and the rumbling steel treads pressed it into the rocky ground as it passed over, squashing it like the carcass of a rabbit on a highway. As it bore Colonel Count Aldo Belli triumphantly up the gorge to Sardi and the Desi Road. At the wall of rock built right across the throat of the gorge, the armoured column ground to a halt, blocked at the very lip of the valley. And when the Italian infantry, who had moved under cover of the black steel hulls, swarmed out to tear the wall down, they met another wave of Ethiopian defenders, who rose from where they'd been lying behind the wall, and immediately attackers and defenders had become so extricated in a single struggling mass that the artillery and machine guns couldn't fire for fear of gunning down their own men. 3 times during the morning, The infantry had been thrown back from the wall, and the heavy artillery barrage that they had directed against it made no impression on the granite boulders. When the tanks came clanking and squealing like great black beetles hunting for a breach, there was none. On the tracks had clawed sparks from the rock, but had been unable to lift the great weight of steel at the acute angle necessary to climb the wall. Now there was a lull that had lasted almost half an hour, and Gareth and Jake sat shoulder to shoulder, leaning against one of the massive granite blocks. Both of them were staring upwards at the sky, and it was Jake who broke the silence. "There's the blue." They saw it through the last eddying banks of cloud that still clung like the white arms of a lover to the shoulder of the mountain, but were slowly smeared away by the fresh, dry breeze off the desert. A ray of brilliant sunlight burst into the valley and threw a rainbow of vivid colour in a mighty arc from mountain to mountain. "That's beautiful," murmured Gareth softly, staring upwards. Jake drew the watch from his pocket and glanced at the dial. 7 minutes past 11. He read the hand. "Just about right now, they'll radio them that the clouds are open. They'll be sitting in the cockpits, eager as fighting cocks." He patted the watch back into his pocket. "In just 35 minutes, they'll be here." Gareth straightened up and pushed the lank blonde hair off his forehead. "I know one gentleman who won't be here when they come." "Make that two," Jake agreed. "That's it, old son. We've done our bit. Old Lige Mackell can't grouse about a couple of minutes. It'll be as close as to noon and as pleasure as to sin." "What about these poor devils?" Jake indicated the few hundreds of Harari who crouched with them behind the wall of rock, all that remained of Ras Ghulam's army. "As soon as they hear the bombers coming, they can beat it off into the mountains like a pack of long dogs." "After a bitch," Jake finished for him and grinned. "Precisely. Someone will have to explain it to them. I'll go and fetch young Sara to tell him." And he crawled away, using the wall as cover from the Italian snipers, who'd taken up position in the cliffs above them. Priscilla the pig was parked 500 yards back in a grassy wrinkle of ground under a screen of cedar trees beside the road. Gareth saw immediately that Vicky had recovered from the state of collapse in which they'd found her, although she was haggard and pale, and the torn rags of her clothing were filthy, stained with dried blood from the long flesh wound between her breasts. She was helping Sara with the boy, who lay on the floorboards of the cabin, and she looked up with an expression which told of regained strength and determination. "How's he doing?" Gareth asked, leaning forward through the open rear doors. The boy had been hit twice, and had been carried back from the killing ground of the gorge by two of his loyal tribesmen. "He'll be all right, I think," said Vicky. And Gregorius opened his eyes and whispered, "Yes, I'll be all right." "Well, that's more than you deserve," grunted Gareth. "I left you in charge, not leading the charge."
"Major Swales."
Sara looked up fiercely, protective as a mother.
"It was the bravest..."
"Spare me from brave and honest men," Gareth drawled. "Cause of all the trouble in the world." And before Sara could flash at him again, he went on, "Come along with me, my dear. Need you to do a bit of translating." Reluctantly, she left Gregorius and climbed down out of the car. Vicky followed her and stood close to Gareth beside the side of the hull.
"Are you all right?" she asked.
"Never better," he assured her. But now she noticed, for the first time, the flush of unnatural colour in his cheeks and the feverish glitter in his eye. Quickly she reached out, and before he could prevent it, she took the hand of his injured arm. It was swollen like a balloon, and it had turned a sickly greenish purple. She leaned forward to sniff the filthy stained rags that covered the arm, and she felt her gorge rise at the sweet stench of putrefaction. Alarmed, she reached up and touched his cheek.
"Gareth, you're as hot as a furnace."
"Passion, old girl. A touch of your lily white."
"Let me look at your arm," she demanded.
"Better not." He smiled at her, But she caught the iron in his voice. Let sleeping dogs lie, what? Nothing we can do about it till we get back to civilization. Gareth! Then, my dear, I will buy a large bottle of Charlie and send for the preacher man.
Gareth, be serious.
I am serious. Gareth touched her cheek with the fingers of his good hand. That was a proposal of marriage, he said. And she could feel the fiery heat of the fever in his fingertips.
Oh, Gareth, Gareth!
By which I take it you mean thanks but no thanks. She nodded silently, unable to speak. Jake? He asked, and she nodded again.
Oh, well.
Could have done a lot better. Me, for instance. And he grinned, but the pain was there with the fever in his eyes, deep and poignant. On the other hand, you could have done a lot worse. He turned away abruptly to Sarah, taking her arm.
Come along, my dear.
Then over his shoulder. We'll be back as soon as the bombers come. Get ready to run.
Where to?
She called out to them.
I don't know, he grinned.
But we'll try to think of a pleasant place. Jake heard them first. So far off that it was only the hive sound of bees on a drowsy summer's day, and almost immediately it was gone again, blanketed by the mountains. Here they come, he said. And almost immediately, as if in confirmation, a shell burst under the lee of the rock wall, fired from the Italian battery a mile down the gorge. The yellow smoke from the marker poured a thick column into the still sunlit air.
Move!
Shouted Gareth, and placed the silver command whistle between his lips and blew a series of sharp blasts. By the time they'd hurried along the wall, making certain that all the Harari had understood and were running back down the valley into the cedar forests, the drone of approaching engines was growing louder.
Let's go, called Jake urgently,
and caught Gareth's good arm. They turned and ran, pelting back across the open ground to the lip of the valley, and Jake looked back over his shoulder as they reached it. The first gigantic bomber came out of the mouth of the gorge, and the spread of its black wings seemed to darken the sky. Two bombs fell from under it. One burst short, but the second struck the wall, and the blast knocked them both off their feet, slamming them savagely against the earth. When Jake lifted his head again, he saw through the fumes and smoke the gaping breach it had blown in the rock wall.
Well now, the party is definitely over, he said, and hauled Gareth to his feet.
Where are we going? Shouted Vicky from the cabin below them, and neither Jake in the driver's seat nor Gareth in the turret replied.
Can't we just drive up the road to Desi? Sarah demanded.
She sat cross-legged on the floor of the cabin, with Gregorius's head cushioned on her lap.
We could fight our way through those cowardly gallas.
We've got enough gas to take us about another 5 miles.
Our best bet is to drive to the foot of the Amber Sakal,
Gareth pointed to the towering bulk of the mountain that rose sheer into the southern sky.
Ditch the car there and try and make it on foot across the mountains.
Vicky crawled up into the turret beside him and thrust her head out of the hatch. Together they stared up at the sheer sides of the amber.
What about Gregorius? She asked.
We'll have to carry him.
We'll never make it. The mountains are crawling with gallus.
Have you got a better idea?
Gareth asked, and she looked despairingly around her. Priscilla the pig was the only thing that moved in the whole valley. The Harari had vanished into the rocky ground on the slopes of the mountains, and behind them the Italian tanks had not yet come in over the lip of the valley. She lifted her eyes to the sky again, where only a few wreaths of clouds still clung to the peaks, and suddenly her whole mood changed. Her chin came up, a new colour flooded into her cheeks. Her hand shook as she pointed up between the peaks.
Yes, she cried. Yes, I've got a better idea. Look! Oh, won't you look!
The tiny blue aircraft caught the sun as it banked in steeply, turning in under the rearing granite cliffs, and it flashed like a dragonfly in flight.
Italian?
Gareth stared up at it.
No, no! Vicky shook her head. It's Lige McCall's plane. I recognize it. It came to fetch him here before.
She was laughing almost hysterically,
her eyes shining.
He said he'd send it. That's what he was trying to tell me before he was cut off.
Where will it land? Gareth demanded. And Vicky scrambled down into the driver's compartment to direct him towards the polo field beyond the burned and still smoking town. They watched anxiously, all of them except Gregorius, standing on the edge of the open field, close beside the bulk of the car, all their heads craning to watch the little blue aircraft circle.
"What the hell is he doing?" Jake demanded angrily. "The eye ties will be here before he makes up his mind."
"He's nervous," Gareth guessed. "He doesn't know what the hell is going on down here. From where he is, he can see the town has been destroyed, and he could probably see the tanks and the trucks following us down from the gorge."
Vicky turned from them and ran back to the car. She climbed up onto the turret and stood high, waving both arms above her head. On the next circuit, the little blue puss moth dropped lower, and they could see the pilot's face in the side window of the cockpit, peering down at them. He banked steeply over the smoking remains of the town, and the lower wing pointing directly at the earth, and then he came back at them, this time only 10 feet above the field. He was staring at Vicky. And with a lift of her heart, she recognized the same young white pilot as had flown Lidge McKell. He recognized her at the same instant, and she saw him grin and lift a hand in salute as he flashed past. As he came out of his next turn, he was lined up on the field for his landing, and he touched down and taxied tail up to where they stood. As the light aircraft rolled to a halt, they crowded up to the cabin door. The wash of the propeller buffeted them savagely, and the pilot slid back the pane of his window and shouted above the noise of his engine, "I can take 3 small ones, or 2 big ones. Jake and Gareth exchanged a brief single glance, and then Jake jerked the cabin door, and roughly they thrust the 2 girls into the tiny cramped cabin.
"Hold it!" Gareth shouted into the pilot's ear. "We've got another small one for you."
They carried Gregorius between them, trying to be as gentle as haste would allow. The pilot was already turning the machine into the wind, and they staggered after it, lifting the boy's body into the open door as it was moving.
"Jake!"
Vicky shouted, and her eyes were wild with grief.
"Don't worry," Jake shouted back, as they tumbled Gregorius across the girl's laps. "We'll get out. Just remember I love you."
"I love you too," Vicky called back, and her eyes swam with bright tears. "Oh, Jake!"
He was struggling to close the cabin door, running beside the fuselage as the aircraft gathered speed for the takeoff. But one of Gregorius's feet was holding it open. Jake stopped to free the foot, and the rifle fire snapped past his head and twanged into the canvas fabric of the fuselage. He looked up in time to see the next shot star the side window of the cockpit, and then go on to strike the young pilot in the temple, killing him instantly, and knocking his body sideways so that it hung drunkenly out of the seat, held only by the shoulder straps. The aircraft slewed sideways at the loss of control, and Jake saw Vicky reach over the pilot's body and close the throttle. But he was turning away and running back towards Priscilla the pig. More rifle fire kicked up spurts of dust around them as they ran.
"Who are they?" he shouted at Gareth.
"On the left." Jake twisted his head and glimpsed the Italians in the scrub and grass, 200 yards away on the edge of the field. Beyond them was parked the transport that had carried them ahead of the lumbering tank formation. Priscilla's engine was still running, and he headed her in a quick turn for the riflemen in the grass. Above him, Gareth fired the Vickers, and the Italians jumped up and ran like rabbits. One quick pass scattered them, and a burst of Vickers fire exploded the transport in a dragon's breath of flame. And then Jake swung the car back to where the little blue aircraft stood forlornly on the edge of the field. He parked the tall steel hull close beside her to screen her from Italian snipers.